Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 13th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first story of the Triangle Business Journal, top of the fold, Verizon fans finally mobilized at PNC, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. After seasons of weak signals, poor connections, and bad service, most fans heading to the PNC Arena will have better reception this year. That is, if you believe folks at AT&T and Verizon Wireless, who say they have reached an agreement, finally. And it took almost a legal complaint to get the job done. Last year, the Centennial Authority reached an agreement with AT&T to install a cellular distribution system that increases cell service in the arena. The authority, which acts as the landlord of the arena, expected AT&T to reach an agreement with Verizon and other carriers to allow fans with other services access to their system, something that is also required by federal communication laws. AT&T installed the system but never reached an agreement with Verizon or other carriers, so even though the authority touted a better cell experience at hockey or basketball games, it applied only to those with AT&T. Now Verizon and AT&T have reached an agreement, and customers of both carriers should enjoy the same service. "We are cautiously optimistic that we are going to see Verizon added this season," says Jeff Merritt, the authority's executive director. Cell service issues had become something of a frustration among authority board members who were charged with keeping the arena a top-notch facility and wanted AT&T to reach a deal with Verizon. At a recent board meeting, the members discussed what kind of action they could take to speed the process along, even suggesting that they lodge a formal complaint with the Federal Communications Commission. "This has gone on too long, in my opinion," board member Bill Mullen said at the time. "I think this has gotten ridiculous." Ultimately, that wasn't necessary. Verizon signed an agreement in August and is working to have improved cell service by opening day. In addition to improved cell service, the authority is considering ways to bring other wireless features into the arena, like in-game highlights or other video streamed directly to wireless devices, though nothing along those lines has been finalized at this point. A side note to this article, the Canes are to host a kickoff event on Sunday. The Carolina Hurricanes are gearing up for the 2013-14 season and open training camp on September 11th, before the first official practice on September 12th. The Hurricanes have invited 48 players to their main camp, including 4 goaltenders, 17 defensemen, and 27 forwards. The team will play its first preseason game on Wednesday, September 18th at PNC Arena against the Columbus Blue Jackets. On Sunday, September 15th, the team will host its annual season kickoff event, the Caniac Carnival, at PNC Arena. The team will also hold a red-and-white scrimmage at 1 p.m. that day, giving fans their first glimpse of game action at PNC Arena this season. Carolina opens its 2013-14 regular season against the Detroit Red Wings on Friday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at PNC Arena. Next up, this week's lead article, price erosion. Coastal property market slackens after being slammed by recession, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. Drawn to its proximity to the coast and outdoor amenities, Raleigh residents Carrie and John Malatoris have ended their 5-year search for a place they could one day retire. The Malatorises earlier this spring purchased a lot at the 6,000-acre St. James Plantation near Southport, one of the few big development projects along North Carolina's coastline that survived the housing downturn, primarily because its clubs are self-sufficient and debt-free. "It's like an adult sports camp," Carrie Malatoris says of the couple's decision to settle in at St. James Plantation. "It has the right level of resort amenities without the feeling of being transient." Plus, she says the price was right. The couple paid less than $100,000 for the lot at St. James Plantation that could have sold for $200,000 plus. just a few years ago when coastal home and lot prices were at their peak. The price also included the $15,000 initiation fee to St. James Private Club, with access to four golf courses, an intracoastal waterway marina, and beach club. "You can see why we jumped on that deal," she says. Communities all along North Carolina's southeastern coastline are dotted with good deals for people searching for a home or retirement destination. Home prices in beach communities such as Riceville Beach, Carolina Beach, and Curry Beach are still down 27% to 36% from the coastal region's housing market peak in 2005. Wilmington real estate agents say that bidding wars on houses across the region are becoming the norm. But many of the homes on the market today are still haunted by the ghost of the Great Recession, and buyers looking for a flip-it-quick, profitable return should be aware. "We took a very strong hit, and I don't think we will ever get back to unit sales levels like in 06 and 07, at least not in my professional life," says Wilmington senior economist Woody Hall, a professor at UNC Wilmington's Cameron School of Business. "We are seeing an uptick, but it's not a strong uptick." By Hall's estimates, the average selling price for homes in the Wilmington metro area probably won't fully regain the home value lost since the 2005 peak until 2018, another 5 years from now. "I've been doing this a long time, at least four recessions and recoveries, and this is the first time our MSA has done as poorly as it has coming out of a recession," he says. "Usually our MSA went into a downturn later than the rest of the nation and came back faster. But I think this time, because we were so heavily dependent on construction employment, we took a big ride up and a big ride down." A Reality Track report released in mid-August ranked Wilmington among the bottom 20 major markets in the United States that are lagging behind the real estate recovery. The report showed that Wilmington has had an above-average decline in housing foreclosures and a lower-than-average number of mortgages considered to be underwater, but the market has lagged in other areas such as unemployment, distressed sales, and interest from institutional investors. Wilmington's high rate of unemployed workers, Hall says, has been the biggest drain on the local housing market. Historically, the Wilmington MSA unemployment rate has stayed below the state's unemployment average, but in late 2012, the tides turned, and Wilmington's unemployment rate moved higher than the rest of the states. In July, Wilmington's unemployment rate stood at 9.2%, compared to the state's 8.9%. Employment at the construction industries, in particular, was hardest hit. Hall says in 2007, the construction industry accounted for around 9% of Wilmington's total employment. By 2012, only about 5% of Wilmington's workforce was employed in the construction industry, with total construction employment down still 44% since 2007. But according to some Wilmington real estate agents, the bigger problem now is a lack of an inventory of homes available for sale. "We have plenty of buyers," says R.J. Alex, an agent for Century 21 Swire & Associates and president of the Wilmington Regional Association of Realtors. "But people are cautious about listing their property because they are afraid they'll lose money on it, and for good reason." Of the 9 zip code areas tracked by the Wilmington Area Association of Realtors, only the 28451 zip code covering the Leland area of Brunswick County has fully recovered from the housing downturn. Leland's average home price in 2012 was up 8% since the coastal market peak in 2005. Existing home sale prices in all of Brunswick County, which includes St. James Plantation, were down 27% in 2012 from the peak in 2005, according to a report by housing market research firm Market Opportunity Research Enterprises of Rocky Mount. New Hanover County's existing home sale prices were down 8% in 2012 from 2005 home sales, the Moore report shows. "I think some people are still squeamish because of the price points, especially if they bought in 05, 06, 07, Alex says. "Those people are probably going to take a loss." Homeowners with underwater mortgages, where the mortgage balance is more than the home's value, still account for about 18% of all outstanding mortgages in the Wilmington region, according to Realty Track. That's down from a rate of 22% of seriously underwater mortgages the year prior. In North Carolina, the underwater mortgage rate is around 14%. Alex noted that he has had to walk away from 10 potential home listings in the last month in the Wilmington region because the potential sellers couldn't or wouldn't sell at the price that he estimated he could fetch for the property in today's selling climate. Some homeowners, Alex says, are opting to rent their properties instead of selling if they can secure a rental rate that covers their mortgage and other expenditures. Rental rates right now are good for investors, and that's the way to go if you can cover that mortgage, he says. Rental properties are always hot here in the Wilmington area. Moving to inside the front page, this time Posen strikes sales deal with Sanofi, by Lauren K. Onisorge, from Raleigh. Posen CEO John Plasecka has always been outspoken. Years ago, when AstraZeneca didn't deliver the revenue he expected from an AZ Posen deal for the arthritis drug Vimovo, Plasecka wasn't subtle, calling the partnership a nightmare. Now he's celebrating a new partnership, possibly worth more than $35 million, one for Posen's highly buzzed about low ulcer risk aspirin line, and it's a deal more than 2 years in the making. This time, it's global pharma giant Sanofi at the other end of the table, and Plasecka, just as outspoken as ever, has changed his tone this time around, lauding the deal. But at least via press release, Plasecka was all smiles in 2010 when Vimovo rights were transferred to AstraZeneca. What makes this deal different? Plasecka says it's because Sanofi's philosophy is in line with that of Posen, and analyst opinion echoes the claim. Sanofi was always on our short list. Plasecka says nobody knows the space better than the Sanofi folks. Part of that is because Sanofi has experience with heart attack prevention drugs such as Plavix. Sanofi marketed Plavix, which netted 2.1 billion in euros in sales in 2012. That experience is a critical factor in Plasecka's confidence. Every deal is individual, he says. I think I've made my points about the AstraZeneca partnership. Today's the day to talk about the Sanofi partnership. But one directly influenced the other, says Roth Capital analyst Bert Hazlett. He calls the Sanofi arrangement a fair deal and points out a particular aspect that wasn't present in Posen's arrangement with AstraZeneca. The deal contains promotional and spending levels, he explains. If the sales are not at appropriate levels, Posen now has means to get the products back, and neither of those terms existed in ways that had any teeth in prior arrangements. Hazlett, like Plasecka, points to Sanofi's experience in the cardiovascular market, place as part of the root of his optimism. I think they have the right partner, so based on Sanofi's presence in the cardiovascular marketplace, we would be a bit less concerned with this deal to begin with. But at the end of the day, having teeth also provides an extra impetus for Sanofi to do the right thing with the product, notes Hazlett. But there's one thing Plasecka and his team won't be able to control now that the two aspiring candidates will be in Sanofi's hands, the pricing model. Plasecka has been vocal about his desire to market the drugs for a dollar a day, while Chief Commercial Officer Liz Cermak says she's optimistic that Sanofi will take Posen's research and opinion to heart. It certainly doesn't have to. That's the last undecided piece of the partnership puzzle for Hazlett. If Sanofi fully adopts the value pricing that Posen has done a lot of work on and put forward, I hope they do. I think it will be a very interesting prospect to see how large and how widely this product can be considered, he says. If it's as big as we think it's going to be, I would think there would be considerable attention from investors going forward. And that credibility might mean more deals. Plasecka says there are still partnership opportunities for the drugs outside of the U.S., as well as possibilities with a higher dosage for pain and arthritis. We weren't going to develop that any further than we have to date until we sign a partnership, he says. The deal is the 91st in-licensing agreement for Sanofi, according to spokesperson Carrie Brown, who says the drugs dubbed PA-32540 and PA-8140 will not only serve as a key foundation for the growth of our cardiovascular franchise, but provide the potential to expand into new indications and new product combinations. Next up, Amanda Hoyle. Ms. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. Her lead article in this week's column is Flowers Say Retail Center Ready to Bloom. With the new Harris Teeter Grocery Store opening next week at the new Flowers Crossroads Shopping Center in Clayton, Flowers Plantation developer Rebecca Dell Flowers has marked another major milestone in her family's history book. Flowers, the only daughter of Johnston County land baron Percy Flowers, says she is looking forward to welcoming the executives from Harris Teeter in town on September 18th to open the doors to the new store at the entrance to Flowers Plantation on NC 42. This is the first Harris Teeter in Johnston County, and remarkable that not only will it be open 24 hours a day, it also has a fantastic Starbucks inside, says Flowers, who has been planning to add a commercial element to the 3,000-acre Flowers Plantation community since construction of its first home started in the late 1990s. Flowers Plantation now has more than 2,200 home sites developed and room for another 5,500 more homes. The Flowers Crossroads will be a turning point in mixed-use development here in Johnston County, she says. It will open the doors of true neo-traditional living, which lends itself to pedestrian traffic. Rebecca Flowers had a few years ago sold a commercial lot to another development group that opened a Food Line anchored shopping center near Flowers Plantation. But with Flowers Crossroads, she decided to tackle the project herself using a mix of financing options from her personal assets and bank loans. She secured a long-term lease deal with Harris Teeter, one of the premier grocers in the region, and hired Crossland Southeast of Charlotte to manage the construction phase. York Properties of Raleigh will be in charge of management and leasing of the 28-acre retail center, which still has 13,000 square feet of small shop space available in the first phase and three outparcel lots also available. Flowers adds that she expects to announce details for a new continuing care retirement community planned near Flowers Crossroads in 2014. Here are some notable commercial real estate lease deals from the past week. Highwoods Properties confirms details of a long-term build-to-suit lease deal with MetLife. The life insurance company's new global technology and operations hub will occupy all 427,000 square feet of office space planned in two buildings on Weston Parkway in Cary. Highwoods will invest $110 million in the construction of the new office park, but terms of its lease contract with MetLife were not disclosed. The buildings are expected to be completed in the first half of 2015. Also, HCL Technologies, one of the largest IT and software companies in India, has subleased 52,800 square feet of office space from another technology company, Genband, at the former Nortel Gateway campus, now called Park Point, in Research Triangle Park. And finally, private equity and commercialization firm Eight Rivers Capital has leased 12,574 square feet at the Crow Building at American Tobacco Campus in downtown Durham. Eight Rivers will be expanding and relocating from Durham's West Village. This week's column of commercial and residential real estate includes an article called By the Numbers. United Van Lines released a report on the 2013 summer peak season moving trends, and Raleigh for the first time ranked among the top 15 most popular moving destinations in the country, coming in at number 8. The Raleigh region had 643 shipments inbound between May and August 2013, or 55.8%, and 510 shipments outbound, or 42.2%. What follows are cities with the highest moving influx, more people moving in than out. San Jose, California, 51%. Portland, Oregon, 42%. Houston, Texas, 29%. San Francisco, California, 26%. Charlotte, North Carolina, 25%. Seattle, Washington, 22%. Tampa, Florida, 15% inbound. Raleigh, North Carolina, 12% more people moving in than out. Denver, Colorado, 11%. And finally, Atlanta, Georgia, 11%. Moving closer to the inside of this week's Triangle Business Journal is Jason DeBrun's column, which covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sport business. The ACA breakdown, the pricing. Two of the three health insurance companies approved to sell plans on the federally mandated exchange have posted at least ranges of the premiums each plan will command. First Carolina Care Insurance Company, a wholly owned subsidiary of Pinehurst-based First Health of the Carolinas Incorporated, has posted full plans, designs, and cost in detail, while Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, headquartered in Chapel Hill, has posted only rate ranges and not given other details. Coventry, which is owned by Aetna Incorporated, has not posted any information as of the TBJ's print deadline. The exchange is the online market where individuals can shop for health insurance. It came out of the Affordable Care Act. The posted rates are only ranges and do not factor in potential subsidies, but are a good first look at what some premiums will look like on the health insurance exchange. More specific prices will be posted by all insurance companies on October 1st. There are listed a bronze plan, a silver plan, a gold plan, a platinum plan, and a catastrophic plan. This week for the Triangle Business Journal, we will only review the platinum plan. And in Blue Cross Blue Shield, that pricing is for a 25-year-old. The range is $319 to $350. For a 40-year-old, $405 to $446. And for a 60-year-old, $862 to $947. Also listed is First Carolina Care. They do not have a platinum plan. They have a gold plan. And for a 25-year-old, it's $342.33. For a 40-year-old, $435.75. And for a 60-year-old, $925.38. According to the NCHA, listed below are the percentages of a hospital's cost, not charges, but actual costs, that the following payers reimburse. For Medicare, the reimbursement is 91%. For Medicaid, it's 73%. And for the uninsured, it is 32%. Next up, Lauren Onisorge's column on Infotech, Biotechnology, and Entrepreneurism. Her lead article is listed as Merck Gets a Vaccine Okay. New Jersey firm Merck got big news this month that its Durham vaccine facility can now manufacture both bulk product as well as finished vaccines. A translation, Merck can now create vaccines that are completely local to Durham from start to finish, and it's a long time coming. Merck currently employs 1,100 people at the facility in Durham. What follows is a timeline on Merck. In 2004, Merck announced it's building its new vaccine manufacturing facility in Durham County. It commits to a $300 million investment and 200 employees. It nabs nearly $40 million in tax incentives and breaks ground on a 235,000-square-foot campus. Next, in 2006, Merck announces its expanded plans for the Durham plant. Merck ups its investment by $100 million and adds 115,000 square feet to the plan. Expansion means 40 to 60 more employees. Then in 2008, Merck announces it's spending another $300 million to expand the vaccine plant, adding 150 to 180 jobs in Durham. In 2010, Durham plans to get approval to produce finished chickenpox vaccines from the vaccine product produced in Pennsylvania. The company announces it's adding 310 more jobs. And finally, in 2013, the plant gets approval to manufacture the bulk product contained in Merck's chickenpox vaccines. Next up, miracle pill could offer relief to MS patients. Biogen Idec could be manufacturing its miracle pill in less than 2 years at Research Triangle Park. That's according to site lead Michelle Sanders, who's been pushing for the pill Tecfidera to be manufactured locally since a collaboration deal was struck with Japanese firm Eisai for its oral solid dosing facility in February. The company is working to transfer the Tecfidera technology to the facility, and it's happening quickly. We have a pretty aggressive timeline, says Sanders. We have to get FDA approval prior to manufacturing. It all depends on the work stream and the workload, but hopefully it will be within the next 2 years or less. Tecfidera, approved earlier this year, is an oral treatment for multiple sclerosis, an alternative to the painful injections that have become standard care. Biogen already manufactures two of its multiple sclerosis drugs in the park, including industry-leading Avonex and Tosibri. Next up, this week's Spotlight column on law. And this is from Chris Bagley. This column is entitled My Take. Mr. Bagley is a former reporter with the Triangle Business Journal and currently attends UNC Law School. Mr. Bagley's column is entitled, Don't Try Entering Law School to Find Yourself. After a journalism career, I've had a few major eye-openers as I move towards a career in law, particularly in how I watch my classmates prepare for the same. I had covered legal affairs and a couple of other beats for the Triangle Business Journal since August 2011, and for 10 years before that, a range of other industries for other publications. Now, a couple of weeks into my first semester at UNC Law School, I'm intrigued at my classmates' reasons for choosing this new career and how seriously they're preparing. It's a weighty decision, particularly nowadays, when more than 10% of graduates of most schools fail to land law-related jobs in the first 9 months after school. I'm certainly aware after chronicling the market for a couple of years. What's really struck me is how many of my classmates have gone in with focus. At least a couple of my attorney friends warned me that, again, particularly nowadays, law school is not a good place to go and, quote, find yourself, end quote. And that doesn't seem to be the motivating factor for many of my classmates. One, Brendan Molani, has worked summers for his family's construction businesses. They've recently branched into real estate, and he aims to help run them after 3 years of school and a couple of years in private practice. Another, Seth Schneer, worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where he worked with attorneys to write rules to implement the Affordable Care Act, commonly called Obamacare. He's considering health care law after he graduates. For my part, I'm tentatively looking at intellectual property and media law and seeking out extracurriculars in those areas. Just 3 weeks in, I can't say whether the majority are this focused. After all, I've sort of gravitated towards other students who have been out in the world for a few years. Meanwhile, the median age among my classmates is 24, and only 9% of us are over 28. My contracts professor, Jeffrey Hirsch, says students who have been out in the world for a few years do tend to be more focused while in school. Relatively few left full careers to go into law, he says. I've only run across one or two who are really punting. Several of my college friends did with law school in the 1990s. It worked out okay for them, given the job market at the time. My classmates now aren't nearly as sanguine. When we discuss our goals for after graduation, the state of the job market comes up often as not. They're serious, too. Nearly everyone is in their seats 10 minutes before a class starts. That's actually pretty surreal, even for a journalist who has dealt with deadlines for years. Were first-year law students always like this? Again, focus and punctuality don't guarantee a job. But what does these days? If anything, people in the job market now have to be adaptable with a lot of skills that we can apply to any job, plus one or two that are irreplaceable in a particular niche. We're fortunate in some ways that the U.S. job market is as flexible as it is. I know plenty of journalists who went through a wave of layoffs or buyouts and have found work elsewhere. I even know a few who are now lawyers. One of my TBJ predecessors recently graduated from Campbell University's law school and passed the bar exam. Meanwhile, TBJ's new managing editor is a former attorney. The big dark cloud, of course, is the debt that hangs over most law graduates, sometimes $100,000 or more. But even the average U.S. college graduate leaves owing $27,000. That tells me we have systemic issues. For now, I've got my eyes open and my nose to the grindstone. My classmates are in the same boat, and I think they know it. This week's column, in case you missed it, considers two particular events. Well, one is the Hopscotch Music Festival that was held September 5th through the 7th, and the second is the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce 125th Anniversary Celebration, which was held on September 10th. That event, the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, celebrated its 125th anniversary September 10th with a program and reception at the Maimende Concert Hall of the Duke Energy Center for Performing Arts. Before a reception that included a good amount of networking for local small business owners, Chamber staff honored the late Senator Vernon Malone as the 2013 A.E. Finley Distinguished Service Award winner. Malone lived and worked in his entire life in Raleigh and its surrounding communities, holding an elective office for nearly four decades. He is credited with leading several initiatives that improved Raleigh and Wake County, but probably none more important than his effort in the merger and desegregation of the Raleigh and Wake County public schools. His children accepted the award. And earlier this week, the Hopscotch Music Festival came to downtown Raleigh, September 5th through the 7th. The music festival featured 175 bands performing in 15 downtown venues over the course of 3 days. The festival is a hodgepodge of musical genres ranging from rock, hip-hop, folk, metal, and dance. Some of the names that performed over the weekend included The Breeders, Spiritualized, Velvet Underground's John Cale, hip-hop legend Big Daddy Kane, A-Track, and many more. Next up, as existing home lag, new construction spikes, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Wilmington. The tides are rising again for new home construction builders along North Carolina's popular southeastern coastline. Building permits issued for new homes so far this year at two of the coast's most populous areas, New Hanover and Brunswick counties, are up 43% and 49% respectively year over year, according to research firm Market Opportunity Research Enterprises of Rocky Mount. At the St. James Plantation development near Southport in Brunswick County, home and lot sales are already up 46% ahead of budget, says Tom Condon, director of sales for St. James Plantation. Condon says they have already 183 contracts processed this year, valued at $30 million. We have been working hard to try and stay ahead of the demand, he says. New construction fever is also starting to spill over into neighboring coastal communities like Beaufort and Morehead City. Savvy Homes, a Raleigh-based home building company, purchased 65 lots in the Bogue Watch community near Morehead City last April and has already sold 11 of the first 15 homes under construction there. I'm about to sit at the table again to negotiate buying the next 100 lots, says Darrell Degree, CEO of Savvy Homes. Degree says his company had already found success the previous 2 years building homes around Jacksonville and Cherry Point, selling to military families and defense contractors. We initially bought these lots at Bogue Watch, thinking that they would be for officers from Camp Lejeune. But as it turns out, the bulk of what we are selling is to second home market. It's people moving from Charlotte or Raleigh to retire or move down to a smaller home, he says. Stephanie Kinder of Apex says she and her husband, Stephen, already had a second home in Sunset Beach when one day she decided to take a drive through St. James Plantation. I drove around for about an hour with my mouth just hanging open, she says. I've been involved in real estate for many years, and I could not believe the houses and the variety they have. The Kinders moved into their new home at St. James in April and will soon be marketing their homes in Apex and in Sunset Beach for sale, she says. Wilmington economist Woody Hall, a professor at UNC Wilmington's Cameron School of Business, says that new home sales in Wilmington market in June rose to their highest levels in 5 years. At the current selling rate, Hall says the market has only a 3.9-month supply of new homes available, which is the lowest inventory-to-sales ratio since fall 2004. Builders are just trying to find lots to build on, Degree says. There's no question that the non-military markets are firming up sales, she says, noting that Savvy Homes has been looking at several other housing development deals towards Wilmington, Myrtle Beach, and Charleston over the last few months, but the competition for lots has been steep. Frankly, it spooked me a bit, he says. Moving deeper inside of this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal, this week's column on small business features Community Association Services Incorporated, Taking the Headaches Out of Association Management, by Jason DeBrun. It probably doesn't enter the minds of most homeowners, but as they drive through their neighborhoods or up to their condos, the grass is typically mowed, lobby chairs are in the right places, and everything is pretty much as it should be. That doesn't just happen by accident, of course, even though those things may go without much notice. Homeowners associations take care of a lot of the routine odds and ends in neighborhoods or condo high-rises, but the folks on those boards don't always want the responsibility of contracting with lawn service or finding the right security company. That's where a company like Community Association Services Incorporated, or CAS for short, comes in. CAS rarely employs pool crews or doormen directly, but works on behalf of homeowners associations to contract with companies that offer those services. Sort of like the middleman who makes sure everything runs smoothly, says CEO John Stone. Although CAS has been around for 36 years, it's managed associations mostly in and around Pinehurst for many years. Stone bought the company in 1999 when the company had only 3 employees. Now it's grown to 79 employees who manage 220 associations and generate $5 million in annual revenue. Stone says there wasn't a magical business formula to get there. It just sort of happened organically. He says he's grown past the 220 association mark, but that gets a little unwieldy. He's dropped below that as well, but then feels like he can take on more. 220 is sort of our sweet spot, he says. Those associations run the gamut. The smallest has only 4 homes, and the largest will be 6,000. The company operates mostly in Raleigh, including the PNC building downtown, although its reach extends from Winston-Salem to Wilmington. Services include the more traditional model in which a manager works with an HOA to properly maintain the neighborhood pool and keep natural areas trimmed, and the on-site model in which a manager actually works full-time on the site. The latter is more common for condo buildings such as the PNC Tower. We've become good at communicating with on-site locations, he says, meaning that he can stay well connected with each property from his headquarters. Of the 79 employees, 28 are managers. Of those, 20 are considered portfolio managers who work with several different HOAs. 8 are of the on-site variety, managing one location each. For the portfolio managers, Stone first thought it made more sense to assign managers to a geographical territory, but quickly found that it actually works better to match personalities of managers with the personalities of the HOA board. More than anything, these managers must engage in conflict resolution, such as when a homeowner is not following a neighborhood code and has irritated a neighbor. Stone says about 20% of the associations typically take about 80% of any manager's time. The biggest problem is finding good managers, he says. We need people that can be problem solvers. Interestingly, he has found success hiring military veterans because of that very reason. We've had a lot of luck with pilots, he says. Before getting into the management business, Stone played tennis and even ranked as the number one doubles player in North Carolina at one point after a college career at UNC Charlotte. He became a tennis pro and began managing tennis clubs. Stone recognized that many tennis clubs were attached to neighborhoods, so he naturally transitioned to managing homeowners associations. He first owned Stone Management Company before buying CAS and jumping into the Raleigh market. Not surprisingly, the association business did well during the good economic years. We were pulled along with the housing boom, Stone said, and we rode that wave. When the economy crashed, Stone figured his business would slow down, but surprisingly, it actually picked up. Stone says he doesn't know exactly why that happened, but surmises it could be because members of HOA boards of directors had more pressures to keep their financial heads above water and didn't have time to manage an entire neighborhood as well. This week's column of Viewpoint, guest column is from Mr. Bob Ford. Mr. Ford is the executive director of the North Carolina Poultry Federation, and his column is entitled, Rising Feed Cost Creating Problems. Last month, a turkey plant in Hope County shut its doors, taking nearly 1,000 jobs along with it. The reason for its closure? Soaring feed prices brought on by the mass conversion of U.S. corn into fuel in an effort to meet federal ethanol mandates. It's clear that the harmful effects of our nation's renewable fuel standard, better known as RFS, no longer linger at North Carolina's doorstep, as our $12.8 billion poultry industry suffocates. Hundreds of thousands of jobs hang in the balance. Food prices swell and our wallets lighten all for fuels that threaten consumer safety. As conceived in 2005, the RFS was intended to lessen gasoline demand, decrease our reliance on foreign oil, and reduce our environmental impact. But factors such as improving fuel efficiency technologies, slow economic recovery, and a domestic energy revolution have since remedied much of these concerns. Even so, the Environmental Protection Agency has continued to raise biofuel blending targets year after year, no matter the cries from a variety of industry and consumer advocates that are all suffering from the mandate's unintended consequences. This year, the EPA has set bioblending targets ever higher, with more than 80% of the 2013 target to be met with corn-based ethanol. The problem? 45% of our nation's corn crop is now used to produce fuel, not food, putting the two in competition with one another. The drastic turnover of the American corn crop in favor of fuel has forced the price of a bushel of corn up by nearly 40% since 2005, to the detriment of food producers across the nation. The rising price of corn directly affects feed prices, as the commodity accounts for up to 70% of the grains fed to animals. The growing number of bankruptcies, closures, and overall financial difficulties that continue to confront North Carolina food producers, whose single largest input cost is feed, are directly linked to the price of corn. In 2012 alone, feed costs increased by 32%, and poultry producers spent an additional $1.4 million per day on corn for feed. It's no wonder the Hope County plant and others like it are forced to shut down. And for what? Higher corn and feed prices have also triggered higher price points for key food items. For example, beef, pork, egg, and fish prices have increased a collective 79% since the RFS was enacted. In addition, the average U.S. family of four has struggled with a $2,000 increase in food costs last year due to higher corn prices, brought on largely by the RFS. All of this hardship is being endured to advance fuels most Americans can't even use. Most vehicles, boats, motorcycles, small engines, and retail infrastructure are incapable of handling fuel containing more than 10% ethanol. Condensation created by fuel containing 15% ethanol, E15, can damage engines and result in corrosion, rust, clogging, and deterioration of fuel system components. Automakers like General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have all stated their warranties won't cover E15 use in vehicles, even those the EPA has deemed compatible with the fuel. Thankfully, momentum to reform the RFS is steadily increasing in Washington. A number of diverse organizations, including poultry, dairy, livestock, farmers, engine and auto manufacturers, car enthusiasts, and environmental groups are concerned with the high cost and dangerous impacts of the RFS. It is critical we support their efforts and demand a stop to the RFS to prevent further harm to North Carolinians and vital state industries. Next is the Editor's Notebook. This week's column is from Rebecca Troyer, who is the managing editor of the Triangle Business Journal. Her column is entitled, "For Me, the Triangle Was Always Home." When I left my home of Raleigh 3 decades ago to attend college in the Midwest, there was no NC 540, no PNC Arena, and no Centennial Campus. Since I-40 hadn't been completed, trips to Durham or the beach took longer. We drove all the way out Highway 70 to pick up our grandma at the airport, welcomed by developer Kid Brewer's enigmatic "You'll be glad you did" sign. My buddies and I roamed and marveled at the sparkling expanse of the Crabtree Valley Mall the first week it opened in 1972. Cameron Village, the shopping mainstay of my childhood, seemed old and quaint in comparison. Cary was a tiny bedroom community, and the American Tobacco Campus was a working factory, where we visited on school field trips and were handed 4-pack samples for our parents. By the time I graduated from Broughton, commercial and residential development had begun to creep northward, but what we natives thought of as the true Raleigh was still comfortably contained inside the Beltline. the explosion of redevelopment and growth that has marked the area since I was a teen has transformed not only the physical landscape, but the entire character of the Triangle as well. What had been two cities, a college town, and a research park have burgeoned into a cohesive regional center of commerce and technological innovation. Our universities are world-class research centers where public-private ventures abound. The Triangle boasts some of the best healthcare facilities in the nation. Some of my old friends and relatives I'll call old Raleighites gripe all about the traffic and new construction. But after living in the stagnant Midwest, where former manufacturing towns struggle to maintain even a static population, the sight and sound of earth movers is refreshing indeed. And after navigating the traffic-choked bridges and tunnels of Hampton Roads, Virginia, where closing just one lane could mean an hours-long Carmageddon, I-40 is a commuter's dream. And I often remind the many friends and relatives who have made a bundle on those inside Beltline houses that growth drives value. As someone with both an insider's and an outsider's perspective, I already knew the Triangle was the ideal place to live, work, play, and do business. Now that I'm back, I look forward to helping report the news, trends, successes, challenges, opportunities, and surprises of this region I have long called home. Glenair, coming into its 20th year in operation, doesn't just label itself a continuing care retirement community. The company, which started in 1993, says it offers a vital lifestyle for the retirees it supports. Under the leadership of Executive Director Paul Gregg, the company penned $18.8 million in revenue in 2012. And it's not just a place to live. The campus houses an auditorium, bank, two libraries, two dining venues, a beauty shop, a music and art studio, an aquatics and fitness center, and more. Here's a quick look at Triangle happenings. Hit the bull, win the stake, and collegiality. Not all of the discussions at last week's global symposium were about the legalities and financing options for expansion in Asia. Lou Arp, Research Triangle site head for ESI, gave an interesting presentation about the cultural differences between Asian and American business professionals. Americans, for example, are much more direct in their dealings and focus on the transactional aspects of the business relationship. Asians, on the other hand, tend to be more indirect and are far more interested in the interpersonal. By way of example, Arp says he was hosting some Japanese executives on-site at RTP for a couple of days. "We'll have a series of meetings here, but I'm taking them to the Durham Bulls game tonight," Arp said. "That's where the real business will be conducted." Continuing the connection between business and sports, start me up, fantasy football style. DigaForce founder Anthony Pompliano sees similarities between building a startup team and drafting for fantasy football. Number one, evaluate talent. Most people spend time looking at draft boards, rankings, historical stats. All of this analysis helps a team owner create the short list of potential draftees, he notes. Number two, pull the trigger. Every fantasy draft decision is under time pressure. Team owners get put on the clock to choose a draft pick. Number three, variety is key. Just as you wouldn't draft 11 quarterbacks for your fantasy football team, you shouldn't build a team of identical minds, he says. Number four, stay the course. Things will go wrong. Build your team with those that can handle adversity. And number five, win. Every fantasy owner sets out to win the league, he explains. With a startup team, you should want the same thing. The American Tobacco Campus will host 2014 Jazz Festival, the birth of cool, where jazz meets app. The Bull City is already trumpeting the 2014 Art of Cool Jazz Festival, and a local company is leading the buzz. Durham-based Bull City Mobile is developing a mobile application that won't just have an event calendar. Insiders tell Biz that attendees will also be able to find artist bios, a map, and local restaurant recommendations. Additionally, the program features an in-app ticket purchasing. The music festival happens April 25th and 26th and takes place all over downtown Durham, including, apparently, on your smartphone. Moving from North Carolina to Africa, building better connections in Africa. Bobbitt Design Build in Raleigh has been playing host the past several weeks to several clinic tech workers from an African-based health clinic program on the borders of Congo and Tanzania. The technicians are building computer and radio network systems that will be used to connect the floating health clinic's teams along the Lake Tanganyika, the world's largest freshwater lake by volume, says Bobbitt Design President Jim Bell. Team member Aaron Huslidge is the son of Bobbitt architect Mike Huslidge. Bell says when they heard about the group's need for office and support space, we saw this as an excellent fit for our philanthropic outreach efforts, serving both the local workers and a broader global effort. We're pleased we could leverage our available resources to help make this project a success. You may be surprised, but lawyers are trained to think on their feet. After Raleigh attorney Heather Bridgers ripped the leather heel on her first ever pair of designer heels, Prada, no less, on an airport jetway on the way to meet a client in New York, she searched the internet for a product that could prevent such a disaster from happening again. But everything I found changed the look of the shoes, she says. She decided to come up with a solution on her own, and a new company was called Just for Kicks was born. Bridgers, a former law partner at Williams Mullins in Raleigh, who broke out on her own to spend more time with her kids, says she worked with researchers from NC State University's College of Textiles to develop an adhesive and heavy-duty polyurethane that could resist scratches and scuffs, yet was thin enough to be nearly invisible to the naked eye. I thought naively that in 6 months we'd have a product, she says. 2 years later, Just for Kicks kicked off production and sales and launching in its first trade show about 4 months ago. The material is made in Massachusetts and the products are assembled and packaged in Durham. She's already started selling the adhesives online, but expect to see products in boutiques and local shoe stores later this year. A set of two pairs for Just for Kicks adhesive retails for $10. Here's some of the news you may have missed from this week's TBJ's website. Walgreen Company buys 76 stores from Raleigh's Car Drug. Raleigh's Car Drug will sell its 76 stores and specialty pharmacies business to Walgreen Company, the company has announced on September 10th. Financial terms were not disclosed. Car Drug's retail drug stores and specialty pharmacy business recorded sales of $381 million last year. Until the acquisition closes, Car Drug and Walgreens will continue to operate separately. Car Drug will retain ownership of its long-term care pharmacy. And UNC Hospitals charts a $143 million expansion. UNC Healthcare is in the very early stages of planning a $143 million project to build a new perioperative building at UNC Hospitals. The new facilities would be 145,000 square feet and include new operating rooms and all affiliated support functions. It would also include a 5-bed expansion. The project would first require approval from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, though that application will be filed later. Also, U.S. News ranks Duke 7th and UNC 30th in the top universities list. Triangle Universities were once again represented highly on the annual U.S. News and World Report ranking of best colleges in the nation. Duke University ranked 7th nationally, while UNC Chapel Hill ranked 30th nationally and 5th among public universities. North Carolina State University ranked 101st in the nation and 46th among publics. As for undergraduate-only business schools, UNCH's Keenan Flagner ranked 7th based on surveys from deans and senior faculty at all undergraduate business programs accredited by the Association to Advance Collegiate Schools of Business. It received a 4.3 out of 5 in the survey. Duke's Fuqua School of Business has only graduate programs. It may interest you to know that Apple's new iPhone technology has a triangle connection. E. Scott Moody, F. Scott Moody, a local entrepreneurial mentor and regular at events such as Startup Madness, had a direct hand in the excitement at Apple's recent new product announcement. The bright, colorful iPhone 5C and the shiny metallic iPhone 5S. Before Moody hit the triangle with a newly founded company, First Talent Ventures, a firm that focuses on advising, mentoring, investing, and sourcing venture capital deals in the Southeast, Moody was the founder of another company, Authentech, where he helped raise $70 million in venture capital. And that company? It develops fingerprint security technology. Apple was so impressed that it purchased the company for $356 million in 2012 and patented fingerprint features last year. And it's the same technology featured proudly on the new iPhones. It may interest you to know that FD Committee greenlights Glaxo's COPD treatment that's developed in RTP. A Research Triangle Park Development COPD treatment nabbed the okay from Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee. Enoro, a GlaxoSmithKline Theravance Incorporated compound that has its clinical development roots at GSK's RTP campus, passed the committee by an 11-2 vote where safety and efficacy data is concerned. The treatment is intended as a long-term, once-daily maintenance treatment for people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, also known as COPD, which typically starts as some people call a smoker's cough. And finally this week, The Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Kent Hoover is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. He tells us that the SBA lenders offer veterans breaks on business loans. Veterans interested in starting or growing a business can expect more help from lenders thanks to a new initiative by the National Association of Government Guaranteed Lenders. More than 100 lenders who make small business administration loans already have signed up for the NAGGL's operation, Vet Access. Participants pledge to increase their lending to veterans, and many are reducing fees on SBA loans or offering lower interest rates to veteran-owned businesses. The association's initiative complements a drive started by the SBA in May to get lenders to commit to increasing their lending to veterans by 5% a year for the next 5 years. This push could get an additional $475 million in SBA loans into the hands of 2,000 veterans, according to the agency. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.